counting on a 10, 9, 8.
We're going to have to turn around all those people who keep saying, but we've always done it that way. It's our young people that are going to have to do it.
1, 0, and lift off.
Welcome to the Ongoing Transformation podcast from Issues in Science and Technology. Issues is a quarterly journal published by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine and Arizona State University. I'm Jason Lloyd, the managing editor at Issues. On this episode, I'm talking to David Beer about social media and how these platforms' algorithms and classifications play a role in shaping our memories and reality. Dave is a professor of sociology at the University of York. His new book, Social Media and the Automatic Production of Memory, which he co-authored with Ben Jacobson, explores these themes. Dave, thanks for joining us today. I just finished your book and it got my brain spinning in really terrific ways. You also recently reviewed David Arditi's book, Streaming Culture for Issues, which dealt with similar topics.
Maybe a good place to start, could you tell me a little bit about chamber psych?
Sure, thanks. Yeah, the chamber psych thing that I started the review with, that was from Spotify, and it was the end of year review thing that they produce. It's like an automated narrative of your music tastes that Spotify creates on your behalf and provides you with, and it tells a bit of the story. And one of the aspects of the story is about genre. So I've had this interest in genre as part of a broader interest in archiving, you know, how media, new types of media platforms can be understood through kind of an archival lens. And then you start to think, how are they organized? What are the classifications that are going on within these spaces? And that sort of thing they're really interesting. The sort of grids that we put culture into are really interesting, very vibrant, I think, as a result of the new types of media structures. So it struck my top five genres last year. I can't remember now which number it was at, but it was in the top five, was chamber psych. But I didn't know what that referred to or which artist, which songs that referred to. It was a genre label I was unfamiliar with. So I found myself, as I mentioned in the review, searching for the genre that described my own taste so that I could understand how my tastes were being classified, really, or categorized. And I thought that was interesting. I think the thing that drove it, don't mention the review, I think the thing that drove it was listening to the band Super Furry Animals, and then a couple of other things that I'd listened to must have been categorized as that as well, I think.
And that's how the platform kind of slots those artists, or does it categorize them by album or song?
Yeah, I think it's by song, but I suspect it filters through from the artist. So, you know, the songs I imagine can be tagged with more than one classificatory kind of label, but that seems to be the one. But, I've been listening to the Super Animals for about 25 years, and I've never heard them described as chamber psych. So it's interesting how these labels then start to take on a presence in the within these platforms, even if they're not perhaps labels that we might use ourselves. The other genres are more familiar, but it just struck me that it's indicative of the vibrancy of the kind of classificatory systems that are going on in media structures, I think.
Yeah, I was really struck by the fact, I think you mentioned in the review, that Spotify has more than like 2,000 different types of classifications for the various types of music that they host, and chamber psych obviously being one of them. I was wondering, so could you just talk a little bit more about the role of classification in a streaming platform like Spotify, but also in other social media platforms such as Facebook?
Well, I think consumer culture is full of this kind of classificatory systems. You know, if you the comparable thing on Spotify, you get on Netflix, you get on Amazon, these labels that very specific granular types of labels that are used to organize content. I think this is driven in part by people's involvement in the platforms, but it's also to do with the amount of content that there is out there, and that needs to be organized. And we're familiar with ideas about algorithms sort of presenting content back to us, but I think alongside that, you know, sometimes focus less upon the classificatory systems, the kind of archival systems that are active. So once you get all this massive content, like you get all these films, all these TV shows, all these podcasts, all these songs available, and you move to a kind of access type cultural consumption, you need ways of organizing that so that it's manageable. It needs to be rendered fathomable to a consumer. And one of the ways this works is through classificatory systems taking on a greater level of significance, I think, within the media structures. so that people can then find their way around and find culture they might be interested in. So you get the automated thing presenting you with suggestions, but there's also the classificatory structures that allow us to organize this content in different ways. So you get that in the consumer culture kind of platforms like Spotify, Netflix, Amazon, and so on. But you also then get it within social media with people using like hashtags and so on to try to organize content within those spaces. There's classificatory systems that work there as well. You had it with tagging in the past, you know, tagging photos and so on. So these are kind of classificatory systems. Some of them are user generated classifications. Others feed off that, but are led by the platforms. And there's this interesting mix, I think, there of kind of everyday classifications that people use combined with the classificatory schemas that are applied or imposed onto culture by the platforms themselves or actors within them. You know, it's a quite interesting mixture, I think, of agendas going on within classification of culture and content. But behind it all is there's so much there. You need ways then of managing it. And these are vast archives, as I see them, as of content that then classificatory systems allow us to access and allow us to retrieve the things that we might be interested in.
So I was really struck, I had not given this any thought, but how a platform like Facebook sort of takes a post and assesses it for what it's going to, how it's going to classify it, then how it ranks it, and then how it determines whether or not it's going to feed it back to you as a memory. And just the fact that I assume it has some sort of AI that looks at the image itself or classifies the image in some way, maybe fairly generally as like, you know, two people on a beach or something like that. And then it also looks at how it's tagged, the comments on it. I guess they do some linguistic analysis on whether those comments tend to be good or bad. And so the platform has a sense of whether or not, or it purports to have a sense of whether or not this this post or this photograph will be positive or negative for the user. And that just, I had not thought about that.
Well, there's a, you know, and that's where that the interesting thing of these things is archival and thinking about classification is to understand the kind of politics of those archival structures, what they allow to be said, what comes back to us, what we see, what we encounter then are all a product of those archival structures and that kind of politics. Memory then is a part of that. So that was the collaborative work I'd done with Ben Jacobson, who's written sort of widely about algorithmic memory as well. And yes, we were trying to understand in particular the classification and ranking processes and then how people responded to them. That's the kind of three movements in the book. And it was that interest, it was that the sort of one of the starting points really was understanding that Facebook had a taxonomy of memories types, and that content was then slotted into literally a grid. And in the way you've described, it's kind of assessed, and the images, the comments and so on are used to place memories within a grid. And then at that moment, then our past content, that as social media become memory devices, so as we live in social media, they become memory devices. And that past content then becomes slots into these pigeonholes, these categories of types. And in that moment, then you're deciding, well, what of that content we create constitutes a memory? And also then what type of memory is it? So at that moment, then memory becomes part of the logic of social media, because it's the types of things that social media want us to engage with as memories are going to be the types of things driven by the logic of stickiness and sharing and commenting and engagement. So we thought that was quite an interesting to see the grid, because we use Facebook in this, but what we were pointing towards is a broader set of trends in social media through memories, you know, that you have a memory kind of culture that we've got there. And also mobile devices doing something similar, but we used Facebook as a way into that because we'd got this taxonomy. So we did that, yes. And then once classified, they're ranked for their worth or value, which is partly to do with the prediction of what the person will want to remember and when. And then we looked at how people respond to those recirculated and sorted versions of their own past.
Yeah. And you touched on this just now, but you know, when you think about the goals of the platform, what this kind of classification scheme, the targeting and sort of regurgitating of your memories, what the objective is for that, I'm thinking of other sort of related concepts, like James Scott's ideas about legibility in the state. In order to give visibility and control over the population, they need, you know, a census, a sense of who lives there and where they are and what they do. In this case, it wouldn't be for, you know, for something like taxation or conscription. What is the, why does Facebook, why is this useful for them? What do they do with this these systems?
Well, I mean, because people have been living on social media platforms and using social media platforms for a significant amount of time, we've built up a series of biographical traces about our lives within those platforms. Now, instantly then, if you run a platform and you want to have kind of maximized personalization, then having people's biographical traces is a significant, valuable resource for knowing them. It's a way of, you know, knowing people through those pasts. And that becomes then a resource for maintaining engagement in the present. So there's obviously things like nostalgia and memories are powerful things for people in their understanding themselves, but also their understandings of their friendships and relationships and connections with other people, collective understanding of what's going on. So this can generate significant activity because what you're looking to do is maintain people in that platform as long as possible each day. That's the objective because, I mean, really, some of these social media platforms, they can't grow much bigger in terms of the number of users. What they're looking to grow is the level of engagement that people have with the platform, particularly as they're competing more with each other, I suppose, a little bit on this now as well, with generational shifts and so on. So, yeah, so you've got there, and it doesn't have to be a long time in the past. It can just be a previous year or whatever. You know, it's not, you don't have to be recalling long periods of time for it to work, but it gets people engaging with their own past and with shared moments that then recirculate and trigger activity in the present. So they therefore it fills the gaps, it fills the voids within social media for us to say something or respond or act within the platform, to be active. So it gives us an option, a little bit like memes, I think. They become kind of these anchor points for activity that allow people to fill the spaces of social media and satisfy the obligation for kind of activity, I suppose.
Yeah, and it seems really effective. Yeah. I mean, one of the part of the book is about, as you mentioned, the sort of user response to this, the memory feature. Could you talk a little bit about what you found in when you talked? You did focus groups and some structured interviews, right?
Yeah. So this was off Ben's project, Ben Jacobson's project. He'd performed these interviews and he's been writing about those. And this became a kind of side project to that, really, around classification and ranking. So we looked at what it was, a kind of unexpected insight that came off the back of that. And we start to think about ranking and classification and then how people were responding to their past content being classified and ranked. And we found some, we use Imogen Tyler's term, classificatory struggles within the space. So it's not like these things fit seamlessly in. They do generate activity and they do generate content and stickiness, but they also create other outcomes. So these are things, we detail this a bit in the book, but they're things to do with misunderstandings of memory. So presenting back things that weren't that significant to the individual. That was one of the examples, you know, one of the things we look at. We also look at the way that sometimes it can feel invasive, you know, that it's part of the kind of surveillance. I suppose it's kind of that sort of creepy over surveillance you sometimes get from these platforms that unsettles you. And in other instances, it was almost like this reaction against the polished, sleek kind of version of their past that didn't feel quite right. It didn't, you know, it didn't sit well with people to have their past packaged in quite such a neat way. That was one of the other things that we found. So people were engaging and showed that they were entertained and amused by these memories, or that they saw it as useful in some instances. But there was also these kind of struggles, uncertainties, kind of unsettling kind of properties to it as well sometimes that people found.
It strikes me as sort of paradoxical that people would find these two sort of polished, because the sort of conventional wisdom about what you put on social media is that it's your, you know, it's your vacation photos and the studio pics of your baby and things like that. And the idea that, you know, in a year's time, it would come back to you as a memory and you'd find it too, too sleek.
I mean, people use those types of terms and in their response to it, but maybe part of this is, you know, that people's an automated story of your life can create a kind of unsettling presence, or it can clash with your own version of your own past and therefore feels wrong. Or it might just be that people don't, you know, have a kind of an uneasy sense of automation within the space in which they, that we use Walter Benjamin in the book as a as an illustration fragment from Walter Benjamin about how memories generate, gain authenticity through the digging, through the actual digging them up, unearthing the memory actively is how they gain legitimacy. And here, maybe it's the fact that because people aren't digging them for themselves, when they're presented back, there's a sense that they lack authenticity or lack kind of legitimacy. I mean, we problematize notions of authenticity in the book, but you can see how that might then lead people to have this sense of, it might be communicated as a sense of not liking the kind of polished nature of what's presented to them. That's part of their response, perhaps, to automation.
That's really interesting. I wonder, so you sort of point to this in the book a bit as a potential path for future research, but I was wondering if you were to speculate on what effect this automated production of memory, what these algorithms are doing, both to the individual and maybe to kind of social relations more broadly, what do you think is sort of will be the effect?
It will change what we remember and how and when, because the devices, with the things we're encountering from our own past are coming up through the devices. So what we remember and how and when we remember it is going to be filtered through this archival structure. I think that's already happening, you know, that's in place. I think that there's the potential there for a reworking of what the notion of a memory is, so that the what we understand to be a memory could change as a result of this, that it is something that's in the platform as well, and that's automated and that is provided to us. And the selection of what a memory is by this system could then lead us to see memory through that lens potentially. So there's a possibility for that there. And then I think the third thing is that this will have consequences for individual notions of self potentially and identity, but also collective remembering. I'm not sure we understand fully what the implications are for collective memory and therefore for solidarity, social connections and social divisions that could come from a transformation in the collective memory, when memory is something that's personalized through algorithms and is fragmented at the level of the individual, perhaps potentially. So I think there's three things there: how, when we remember, what remember, what we understand the memory to be, but also how individual and collective memory might operate in the future, particularly as these things become more and more embedded, more active, and potentially more predictive.
This type of feature seems to be kind of everywhere. I assume it's in part because they've just found it so effective, a really effective way of increasing engagement. But, you know, it's on your phone. So obviously, Spotify is now sort of famously has this year-end feature where they feed you back, you know, memory of the year in music. So, yeah, it doesn't seem like it's going away anytime soon.
I don't think so. I think it's, you know, as we were working on it, the first thing I did on this maybe about 4 years ago or something like that, 4 or 5 years ago, on the memory thing, and you can just see it escalating. You know, most of these platforms and devices have got their version of presenting your past to you, you know, or the automatic sort of automatic production of our past. That seems to me to be sort of spreading out into these platforms and devices, and they've just got more and more biographical traces on which to use, but also now the accumulation of data about people's engagement with those recirculated memories, which then feeds into the system itself, so they can then use that to try to be predictive about which types of memories work, you know, and what to rank as being the memory to send back to you. The consequence of that are difficult to predict, really, because it might be that narrows down memory, or it might be that they find that they want to try to create ways of being unpredictable, because that's what people are, you know, so you don't know, but it's going to get coded into the algorithms.
Yeah. So you and your co-author on this book, Ben Jacobson, did a really deep dive into this feature that is maybe, I mean, it seems a fairly significant part, but in some ways kind of tangential to what the platform, you know, the overall structure of the platform and what they try to do to increase engagement. So I'm wondering, what do you think about overall kind of what social media is doing after having looked at this particular feature that seems to have been built in such a way as to, I don't know, it just has all these complexities and and tensions in it, potentially sort of manipulative kind of approach, although not necessarily, but it just, it seems like this particular feature is such a rich source of research and tension. Like, how does it make you think about the larger platform itself as, or social media itself?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, this project is part of trying to build up a bigger picture around the way that these systems work and what their objectives are and what the sort of politics of platforms is and data and algorithms and that kind of thing. And I think you can understand this in terms of the broader transformations that we've seen through social media as it builds up. I did another book called The Data Gaze, which is about how this sort of gaze is exercised on us, how we're watched through platforms and through by data. So, well, I think you can see the memory thing in terms of the broader political economy of platforms and particularly social media, which is about the data. The data of the archived users is really where the value is in social media. That's where the predictions are, because the idea is you can use the data to be more predictive about individuals and therefore target content towards them in ways that, where value can be extracted. So I think you can see the memory thing in that broad term. So what you want to do is keep people engaged with the platform as much as possible, because that generates the maximum amount of data about those individuals, which then lends itself value. Now, I'm not saying they can use the data to achieve the things they say they can achieve, but it's the notion that that data is of value. The ideas around value attached to data are the really important thing in terms of understanding the activities of a number of these platforms, I think. So you can see the memories thing, I think, through the broader ideas around data capitalism, probably.
And engagement.
Engagement really equals data production and stickiness. You know, these are things that create the, you know, that increase the amount of data gathered and therefore create, maximize the opportunities for value to be generated, or for notions of value to be generated at least. Yeah.
What's been your experience with this feature on social media?
Apart from Spotify, which I think I spent, I'm right in saying, I did the calculation. I think I spent 3.64% of 2020 on Spotify. Because you can work out from the hours it gives you, which I don't actually have any social media profiles. And a student asked me about this recently, actually. And I said, well, you know, the reason I don't have any social media platforms is because I do research them rather than, you know, because it's expected to kind of be some sort of social media enthusiast. So I did, when I did my first project on social media in about 2006, 2007, I was working on a program called the eSociety Program, funded by the ASRC with a colleague called Roger Burrows. And it was sort of called Web 2.0 then. And I created a Facebook profile in the thing, and I found it very unsettling. So I deleted that after we'd done a little bit of research on it. And then I did have a Twitter account for about 6-7 years. I deleted that. And the only thing I've really stuck with is blogging, really. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So blogs and working on blogs. Use Medium for a bit, been using Substack, just experimenting with those types of mediums as a way of writing and communicating and being part of a online community. But it's not quite the same thing, is it? But so I, personally, I never get presented with any memories about my past. There's a problem. It's, you know, how do you understand social media from the outside is something that I'm always working with, because I teach this as well. But I actually find it's quite useful, because you can look across platforms internationally and that kind of thing, as to try to understand it rather than being led by a targeted, personalized experience of the social media space. I think that's the way I justify it to myself anyway. But I have a kind of discomfort with social media, but, you know, that's just, I can see the value in social media, understand people's engagement with it. Absolutely do, you know, but it's, you know, I see my job as to sort of try to think skeptically about what's going on and to try to think in sociological terms about broader transformations.
Thinking skeptically about the world and ongoing transformations is also our goal here at Issue. I'm grateful you joined us for this episode, Dave. If you'd like to read more about the new process of digital memory making, check out his book called Social Media and the Automatic Production of Memory. And visit us at issues.org for more conversations and articles, and of course you can read Dave's review there. I'm Jason Lloyd, managing editor at Issues. Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Ongoing Transformation.